One of the best sources of information about the tar sands and what it's doing to water and to the habitat is Clayton Thomas Mueller.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
I'm a Cree man from Pugetawagon First Nation, and I am the Tar Sands campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network.
You're based out of Ottawa. You've been traveling the countryside of Canada talking about what's going on up there with the Cree Nation and Lake Athabasca, etc. You want to fill us in on your tourings?
Yeah, well, you know, a part of my responsibilities with the Indigenous Environmental Network's Canadian Indigenous Tar Sands campaign is all, you know, focused on spanning a political base of resistance, first and foremost in frontline affected First Nations and Métis communities that are, you know, bearing the disproportionate impacts of Canada's most destructive and largest development located in northern Alberta, but also all across this country and in the lower 48 United States. A lot of my work is focused on speaking to, you know, broad community forums, working within the media, and, you know, first and foremost, elevating local leadership from First Nations and Métis settlements that we're working with to speak for themselves on the issue, but of course also doing a lot of educational speaking on the issue myself to try and make people aware of, you know, just for their subsistence. And I think that, you know, it's not just waterways directly in the vicinity that are being affected by industry's unsustainable uptake of water for the tar sands process, industrial process, but it's also, there's a whole host of cumulative effects on water that tar sands development represents. You see, here in Canada, the tar sands at its current rate of expansion will grow to represent, you know, anywhere from 150 to 177 million tons of carbon dioxide per year.
Can you get in more detail as what that is?
You know, Canada basically, you know, Canada's tar sands represent the largest driver of the global climate crisis that this country has to offer. By 2030, Canada's greenhouse gas emissions produced by tar sands alone will represent a number larger than all of Canada's automobiles, trucks, you know, trains and cars combined.
Wow.
And of course, you know, Lake Athabasca, Athabasca River, the whole Mackenzie Valley Basin is fed by glaciers in the Rocky Mountains that rely on, you know, critical snowfall and cold winters for the glaciers to continue to, you know, exist and to feed these ancient riverways. Now, unfortunately, one of the effects of climate change are the fact that these glaciers that feed this important river, you know, they're disappearing, and they'll be gone in the next couple of decades, all of which is contributing to a rapidly declining water level in the Athabasca River, which is affecting local communities, the ecology, and even industry itself. And so, you know, that's another issue related to how, you know, critical the water issue is. And when we look at, you know, one of the toxic byproducts of tar sands development, which of course is, you know, the wastewater tailings ponds that, you know, people can see from the U.S. International Space Station. These things are 15 kilometers across. There are multiple tailings ponds located all throughout the Athabasca mining operations. If left unchecked, these tailings ponds at the current rate of expansion will grow to represent a water body collectively the size of Lake Ontario by 2030. You know, people need to be very concerned about this because these tailings ponds leak. It's a well-known fact that there are 6,000 liters per second of toxic effluent, you know, leaking from these tailings ponds directly into the Athabasca River every second of every single day. And, you know, of course, all of this is going downstream through the food chain and all the way up into local communities that still heavily subsidize their diet through traditional food sources like fish, moose, muskrat, beaver, and of course through the harvesting of other sacred medicinal plants and food sources, all of which rely on this water, which is being so heavily abused and contaminated by tar sands industry in northern Alberta. And when we take a look at it from a national and international perspective on the water issue, you know, the reality of it is if one of these tailings ponds ever, you know, fails, and believe me, these tailings ponds do fail. Recently in Tennessee, a coal waste tailings pond utilizing the exact same technology failed and filled a valley in Tennessee with a 12-foot wall of toxic coal waste. And this represented a spill of contaminants, that it was equivalent to about 19,000 Exxon Valdez oil spills. They don't even know what to do with the waste. And so in northern Alberta, this is a region that is much more seismically active than where the spill happened in Tennessee. So it's not a question of if, it's a question of when one of these tailings ponds fail. You know, it promises to destroy not just the Athabasca River, but Lake Athabasca, the Mackenzie River, both Great Bear, Great Slave Lake, and all the way out into the Arctic Ocean, destroying the lives of literally dozens of indigenous communities and non-indigenous communities alike. And when we take a look at, you know, what's going on with waterways across Canada, the reality of it is Canada, although we do have the majority of freshwater resources left on the planet, these resources are gravely threatened by tar sands development because, again, going back to the greenhouse gas emissions of the tar sands, you know, it's not just CO2 coming out of this nasty development in northern Alberta. It's all kinds of volatile organic compounds, including NOx and SOx, which are the main causes of acid rain. Some of the listeners may remember the crisis in America with acid rain as a result of coal-fired power plants. Well, you know, in northern Alberta, this oil is so tremendously dirty that it produces a lot of toxins, a lot of air pollution, which of course migrate. And what we're seeing now are lakes in Saskatchewan that are becoming dead zones because of the acid rain created by the tar sands. And scientists have discovered the effects of this all the way into the Great Lakes over in Ontario. And, you know, the reality of it is as this development grows twice, three times to five times its size, we will only see, the effects of air pollution on critical waterways and, in turn, critical, food sources.
Can I get you to go back to food sources? The question that I was referred to was that fish being fried smelling like plastic, and that hunting deer, one hunter opened it up and found that the organs were all green. Can you talk about some of that situation?
In northern Alberta, you know, there are many, many indigenous communities throughout that beautiful and pristine, ecological gem known as northern Alberta, Canada. This is a territory that has been utilized by Cree and Dene, and more recently by Métis indigenous communities for subsistence. Many, many of the local communities still to this day continue to hunt moose and buffalo in the south, deer, caribou in the north, continue to take fish from the lakes, streams, and rivers in the region. But one of the effects that, you know, there has been countless testimony bearing witness to of Canada's tar sands development has been food contamination. And this is a critical violation of fundamental human rights of access to food that is happening, and it's quite sad. especially given that Canada likes to position itself as a defender of international human rights, that it would be violating the human rights of its own local indigenous peoples for economic profit. Some of the testimonies that are coming from fishermen and hunters alike are all pointed at the same thing. You know, meats are not edible because of the fact that hunters, when they're taking apart, you know, moose, when they're taking apart the lodge of the muskrat to get at the muskrat, they're finding them inside all dead with blood coming out of their noses and the smell of petroleum wafting out of these lodges. When they're taking apart the moose, they're finding the meat riddled with, you know, cancerous tumors, with all kinds of, you know, discoloration and you know, nasty aromas coming out that are not, you know, that are not normal. And the same can be said about fish that are being taken from both Lake Athabasca and the Athabasca River. You know, they're finding multiple deformities in fish, you know, all kinds of tumorous cancers and different kinds of pustules, and, you know, straight-up deformities, everything from two mouths to two-headed fish they're finding in their nets. And, you know, a lot of this local traditional land use practitioners are directly attributing to the massive toxic footprint of the tar sands development. Because, again, going back to the tailings ponds, the air pollution, you know, there are all kinds of volatile organic compounds, including massive amounts of mercury and arsenic and other heavy metals that are being released every day into these pristine, you know, beautiful ecosystems, these sacred circles of life that, you know, local indigenous peoples rely on, you know, to be healthy. And there have been tests done on some local hunting catches that have shown that, you know, some of the moose in the region have elevated levels of arsenic that are 600 times the acceptable rate. And, of course, arsenic is a carcinogen. And the other thing they're finding in fish and wildlife are what's called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon, which is basically oil, you know. And recent studies, especially coming out of, you know, Alaska, where the Exxon Valdez oil spill happened 15 years ago, are showing that, you know, oil is a lot more toxic than people thought it was, anywhere from 10 times to 1,000 times more toxic. And when combined with arsenic, carcinogenic qualities of arsenic and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are staggering. And that's why, you know, it doesn't take a scientist to understand why there's a cancer epidemic, you know, blooming in Fort Chippewa, 250 miles north of Fort McMurray, the epicenter of tar sands development.
You are listening to The Other Side of the News on 93.3 CFMU-FM.
Including rare forms of cancer that, you know, are directly attributed to exposure to polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which is a byproduct of tar sands development.
I'm glad you went there, Clayton, because I wanted to ask two questions about the rarity of the kind of cancer that they're finding in humans. But before you go into that, when did people start noticing the pollution of the animals? What year? How many years?
Well, it's all been in the last 20 years. It's only been within the last decade that, you know, tar sands became an economically viable form of development. It's been really, you know, more of a kind of planning for the future by, you know, the oil industry pipe dream. But with, you know, the reality of global peak oil, you know, the tar sands has became, you know, an economically viable solution to the foreign oil dilemma that the United States and its military industrial complex and unsustainable auto-centered off-ramp economy, you know, is looking towards. And so some theorize that the Iraq War and other covert wars happening around the world are strategically aimed at driving the price of oil up because, you know, if the price of oil is not over $50 per barrel on the international market, tar sands oil is not profitable to develop. But seeing the price of oil go up to $150 a barrel, you know, it's floating just below 100 now, but, you know, futures in oil promise that it will go well above $100 a barrel again and continue to make it a very, very lucrative and profitable industry. But you know what? What we've seen, I guess, you know, in the last 10 years is a massive push, a massive investment of capital in expanding the tar sands, you know, and in turn, what we've seen is a tremendous amount of cancer in local communities spike all along the timeline of the expansion of tar sands. If you go to First Nations communities like Mikisew Cree First Nation, like Athabasca, Chipewyan First Nation in Fort Chipewyan, Alberta's oldest community, you'll see that you know, there's been over 100 deaths in the last decade. Many of them rare forms of cancer or other autoimmune deficiencies were the cause of. And, you know, I think most troubling has been the reports of Dr. John O'Connor, who was the local general practitioner for Fort Chipewyan for many years. You know, he ended up coming out to the media and announcing his disturbing findings that, you know, not only was he finding your conventional forms of cancers and lymphomas, you know, that were staggeringly high in a community of 1,200, which is the population of Fort Chipewyan, but he was also discovered, you know, a few suspected cases and upwards to about six suspected cases of colonic, a form of colon cancer, which has been directly attributed to hydrocarbon exposure or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon exposure. And three of those cases were confirmed. Three ended up being something else. But, you know, the reality of it is statistically, you would only find one case in 120,000 of this type of cancer. But, you know, to find three cases all in the time frame of a year in a community of 1,200 is statistically impossible.
Now, sorry, he was basically pushed out of the medical association for that finding, wasn't he?
Well, you know, he definitely had his life thrown through the gauntlet by the Medical Association of Canada. You know, he had multiple charges brought against him by the College of Physicians, you know, by Health Canada. His ability to practice medicine was under threat for some time, and he, you know, had to deal with a lot of attacks as a result of his courage and his valiant effort to step forward and speak out against, you know, what common sense would tell anyone, that industry is causing cancer in Native communities in northern Alberta, and the government of Alberta and Canada is doing nothing about it. And so most of the charges have been dropped, except for the charge by Health Canada of creating undue stress or unnecessary panic in a local community. He's still dealing with that. But Dr. O'Connor to this day continues to practice medicine in northern Alberta, and he continues to be a very visible and vocal spokesperson on the link between you know, human and ecological health and the effects of industry on the both of them.
You mentioned some of this pollution getting down into the Great Lakes, which is the reason for this call. And would you care to elaborate on how it gets down there? Because one of the reasons that I know of is the refineries on Port Whiting on Lake Michigan. Their tailing pond is less than a mile from the edge of Lake Michigan. And it's startling for me to find out that many of these refineries that are dealing with these pipelines so they can continue to transport this dirty oil around are offsetting and putting out pollutants in water tables, or it's leaking, seeping, as you said, from the tailing pond. So it's getting into the water tables two or three different ways.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. It's a really important question, especially for our listeners in the lower 48 United States. A lot of people, you know, I mean, just for the reasons I've been talking about, in terms of the human rights violations, the cancer epidemics of local communities in northern Canada, that should be a good enough reason alone to tell congressional leadership that we don't want no dirty tar sands oil in America. You know, we want clean, renewable energy. We want green jobs. But, you know, another important reason that listeners all across this continent have to be concerned about tar sands development is due to the fact that this is the immense proportions of this project reach coast to coast to coast to coast. And when I say that, I'm talking about, you know, infrastructure, basically. There are pipelines, mega pipelines, coming into tar sands to bring much-needed energy resources for its expansion. I'm talking about the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Project and the Mackenzie Valley Gas Line Project, as well as the Trans-Canada Pipeline Project, bringing, you know, promising to bring natural gas in from northeastern British Columbia. Because to produce tar sands oil, you need a tremendous amount of energy to heat the water they utilize to separate the oil in the water, okay? And they burn enough gas, natural gas, in tar sands right now, every single day, to heat every single home in Canada for 1 year. That's every single home, every single day. And so the development itself is growing. And as these feed sources come online, you know, a lot more oil will be produced out of Canada's tar sands, and the need for transportation ways, you know, to get oil down to the lower 48 where the majority of refinery capacity exists, they're proposing to build multiple pipelines down into the United States through Montana, through the Dakotas, through Minnesota and Wisconsin, you know, all the way down into Oklahoma, all the way to Maine, all the way down to Washington, and all the way across northern British Columbia for mega tankers. And so, you know, there are 33 existing oil refineries in the United States that are going through billion-dollar retrofits to process heavy tar sands crude. A lot of the Gulf Coast refineries in Texas and Louisiana are already set up to produce heavy oil because that's what they produce from the Gulf of Mexico and from places like Venezuela. But other refineries in places like Montana, Wyoming, in Detroit, Michigan, in Whiting, Indiana, where British Petroleum operates, the oldest refinery in the United States of America, just down the shore from Chicago. You know, these refineries are going through multi-billion dollar expansions to be able to produce tar sands crude, which is a much dirtier, bottom-of-the-barrel form of oil. And it's unfortunate, you know, especially when you look at some of these, you know, the propaganda that's created by these companies like British Petroleum, who, you know, spent more money on changing their name to Beyond Petroleum than, you know, pretty much all of humanity has spent on renewable energy up to this point. You know, and they just canceled their renewable energy portfolio and fired their renewable energy boss and announced that, hey, we're going to expand our operations in tar sands in Canada's north. And so, bottom line, people in the United States need to be concerned about, you know, the grave effects of 33 oil refineries producing a much dirtier form of crude oil, especially those communities that live beside the refineries, which tend to be predominantly communities of color, African American, Latino, Asian Pacific communities, you know, and indigenous communities are the ones that tend to live beside these types of harmful, toxic facilities. And so, you know, there is a tremendous need for a powerful strategy that is rooted, you know, in a social movement's framework to build a political base of resistance against, you know, 33 oil refineries, against dozens of pipelines, against the largest development ever in the history of humanity in northern Alberta, that, you know, promises to grow to a size of the state of Florida, you know, we need to come together, both in Canada and the United States, in a strong social movement strategy that's rooted in anti-racism, that's rooted in anti-oppression, to organize against this development and to say, hey, we want a clean energy future. We need a new energy and economic paradigm, not business as usual. And we're not going to allow the United States of America or the federal government of Canada to sacrifice certain communities because of race lines or class lines just so that other communities can continue to thrive economically.
Okay, Sen, can I ask, could you list the names of the oil companies? I know they've changed some names because there's been some mergers.
When you think of the who's who in Canada's tar sands, I mean, you know, if you can think about it, they're either there already or they're standing in line to get in. Canada is a really interesting place because Canada's tar sands patch represents what really is the final frontier or the Wild West, if you will, of the oil and gas industry. I like to refer to Canada's tar sands as home to Canada's greenhouse gangsters and climate cowboys because of the fact that Canada is one of the last places on the planet that does not have a nationalized petroleum reserve. Okay? It's a private oil patch. They have the lowest leasing rates. They have the lowest royalty rates on the planet. And so you have ExxonMobil. You have Shell, you have British Petroleum, you have Totalfina from France, you know, all of the big names are operating there. And then you have some made in Canada, smaller names such as, you know, Syncrude, the angry child of the original operator in tar sands, which is, of course, Suncor, you know, who was started up by the Sunoco Pew family. In the United States back in the day and sold in 1995 for $5.6 billion. And so, you know, you have other places as well, like, you know, the Chinese National State Petroleum firm trying to get in as well on the action. You know, everybody's lining up. There's 177 billion barrels of recoverable crude there. And you know, there are there are about 21 companies operating in the region with all of the big players, BP, Shell, ExxonMobil, you know, Imperial Oil, Syncrude, Suncor, and then some smaller players. And recently, Syncrude and Petro-Canada became one company through a corporate merger and, you know, now represent the largest energy corporation in Canada, you know, and so, and they also happen to be one of the official sponsors of the Vancouver 2010 Olympics, you know, so.
Well, they've got the money to do great greenwash.
No doubt.
Okay, just a couple of more questions. I want to get into the pipelines because a lot of them are there already and people don't know about them. A lot of them are being sabotaged and blown up according to the mainstream media. Can you talk about those?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't know of a lot of pipelines being sabotaged. I only know of the area around Dawson Creek where there has been some sabotage, you know, specifically of Enbridge operations in that region. You know, I can't speculate one way or the other about, you know, the issue of sabotage, but one thing that I do know is that in the area around Dawson Creek, you know, I used to live there when I was a little kid. It's a beautiful region that, you know, is filled with agricultural lands that, you know, has a lot of First Nations in there, a lot of small, sleepy little towns, you know, in an otherwise kind of like a rolling hill prairie region in northern British Columbia, northern Alberta. And, you know, it's only been in the last 20 years that oil and gas, specifically gas development, has expanded tenfold in that region. There's been a very aggressive development in that region, almost overnight, seemingly. you know, that has created all kinds of ecological catastrophes for the local communities in the region, specifically farmers and other land use practitioners in the territory, you know, which has created, I think, a lot of division. And we've seen, you know, recent attacks, if you can call them that, or sabotage on Enbridge pipeline facilities, and there's been an ongoing dialogue, I guess, between the perpetrators of those sabotages and the local police and the corporation that has been exploited by Canada's right wing. You know, there was a recent report from Thomas Flanagan, who is a top advisor for Prime Minister Harper, you know, calling out eco-terrorists and First Nations as the main threat to Canada's oil and gas industry. And so, you know, it's unfortunate that without any proof whatsoever that Canada's right-wing neoconservative establishment is already trying to criminalize local Indigenous communities and environmental communities to basically, you know, polarize the issue so that there is no dialogue, so that there is no solution, and so that anyone dissenting against you know, what's going on in northern British Columbia with the Enbridge developments, you know, will immediately be seen by many as the most extreme kind of eco-terrorist or First Nations dissenter. You know, and so, you know, it's really unfortunate just how dirty politics play out by the right-wing establishment in this country. Now, across North America, you know, there are so many different pipelines, both existing that are being expanded and new proposed projects, I think. And there's a variety of support and resistance against all of these projects. You know, this stuff is really divisive, especially in a time of economic turmoil where people need jobs. Many are looking at the economic short-term benefits of these projects and supporting them, and many are saying that this is not the economic future that we want. We don't want to see our landscapes fractured by this infrastructure. We don't want to see the continuing sacrifice of local communities for this dirty oil, and we don't want this this illegal dirty oil being transported through our communities.
And there's a lot of leaks. There's a Burnaby leak. A lot of leaks are already in the coast.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think Burnaby is a great example. You know, the Kinder Morgan facility, which is a Texas-based company, is trying to expand, you know, their pipeline through Kamloops from tar sands. They've already got an existing pipeline that feeds the Burnaby tank farm and the Burnaby oil refineries, which are 500 meters across the inlet from Burrard First Nation. You know, and so the local Indigenous community, again, living beside three oil refineries in a row there in Vancouver. And there's another pipeline that a lot of people don't know about that's connected to the Kinder Morgan facility that feeds into a refinery in Washington State, which is a Navy petroleum refinery, which is, you know, basically the fuel is going straight into warships that are, you know, on their way to Iraq. So Canada's already, you know, at least a main energy supplier of the war in Iraq, even though they haven't sent soldiers there. You know, Canadian oil is being used to fuel the warplanes and the warships that, you know, have been wrecking destruction in that country on local communities. And so, you know, I think that there are many other battles that are taking place all across the continent. You know, there are a lot of small fires. One of the main focuses of our Canadian Indigenous tar sands campaign is on the Enbridge pipeline on the other side of the continent over in Minnesota. Enbridge is trying to build a pipeline that is an extension from the Keystone pipeline that's, you know, going down to the Dakotas, across Minnesota, you know, through tribal territories of Lake Mead, of Leech Lake Reservation, Fond du Lac Reservation, all the way through to Superior, Wisconsin. And, you know, our organization has been working with grassroots citizens from Fond du Lac and from Leech Lake, you know, to intervene on this infrastructure proposal to say, we don't want no dirty tar sands oil coming through our tribal territories in Minnesota. And you know, we've managed to you know, build a lot of awareness, and we've actually served Enbridge with a summons, and are looking at you know, options around litigation as a result of local communities not being consulted by the tribal council about, you know, the proposed deal between Enbridge and the local tribal council for this pipeline. So there's a lot of resistance that is emerging, especially when people find out about the cancers, about the ecological catastrophe in Canada's North, and what Indigenous peoples, First Nations peoples in Canada's North are facing as a result of this development, that it's much bigger than just a pipeline. It's much bigger than a refinery expansion. It's 33 refinery expansions. It's dozens of pipelines. It's new shipping ways for mega oil tankers on our fragile coastlines of the continent. You know, it's liquid natural gas plants in the Mackenzie Valley Basin. You know, it's just an immense amount of infrastructure of carbon, you know, of greenhouse gases driving the global climate crisis. And, you know, we need a new economic and energy paradigm. We've got to come together and put a stop to this madness known as tar sands.
Okay, a couple of more questions I'm hoping you can answer. The slave wages, where they import workers to work in the tar sands, but they're sort of kept in not very favorable conditions, and once they're used up or not needed anymore, they're shipped out.
Well, you know, the tar sands, you know, is no different than other industries in Canada. You know, I think another industry that utilizes what's called the Temporary Foreign Workers Program, which is a government-approved, you know, basically slave labor program. Temporary foreign workers come into the country. They're the sole responsibility of the employer. The employer is responsible for their health care, for their transportation, their meals, and for their payment. And, you know, in Canada's tar sands, at a time of massive layoffs due to the economic downturn, you know, what we're seeing is a massive push to expand its temporary foreign workers program, which, of course, drives up the profitability of operations. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, you know, they don't know that two temporary foreign workers from China died in Canada's tar sands in an industrial accident a couple of years ago. But the whole world was listening when 1,600 ducks died in one of the tailings ponds.
So you're saying that these temporary workers come from China largely, and so we're using them instead of using our unemployed Canadians.
Well, temporary foreign workers come from China. They come from the Caribbean islands. They come from Mexico. They also come from the Philippines. Temporary foreign workers come from multiple regions across the planet. But the reality of it is they're not privy to Canada's labor laws and labor protections. They're not privy to Canada's health care. And they're living pretty much in an indentured servanty, you know, under, you know, to oil corporations. And, you know, there's been multiple cases of abuse of this program, abuse of those workers. Many of them go home without pay in some cases, or, you know, due to toxic exposure, get sick, and then, you know, are sent home, you know, to deal with their illness with their local health care systems versus, you know, getting health care here in Canada. So there's a lot of really big issues with that development. The Temporary Foreign Workers Program is significantly problematic because it, you know, promises to continue to exploit workers from the global south, to put them in a situation where, you know, their pay is completely inadequate, where they're not informed about the dangers associated to working in such a toxic environment, and really where they're considered expendable by the Canadian public. I think it's really sad, especially when you look at the total labor force of tar sands. 71,000 workers in northern Alberta, you know, to drive this massive beast. 51,000 of them come from Canada's Maritimes, specifically Newfoundland. So you have a labor force that is destroying a new economic sacrifice zone for the national economy that comes from another economic sacrifice zone because, you know, the Maritimes, of course, was home to one of the world's largest fisheries. But due to lack of federal oversight and federal environmental regulation and enforcement and just plain and simple bad economic policy, the fishing industry collapsed. And, you know, thousands were left unemployed and poverty and other socioeconomic, problems went through the roof. And, you know, a lot of those old fishermen and new young people, when you turn 16 in the Maritimes, you go to Canada's tar sands. And I think it's really a multi-layered situation when you look at labor, that is exploitive on many, many different ends because you have temporary foreign workers in a situation where their human rights are being violated. You have workers from the Maritimes being utilized in a very exploitive industry that's, you know, killing local First Nations and Métis people, that's destroying critical carbon sink, the boreal forest of Canada.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing boreal forest up. Can you explain to our American counterparts what the boreal forest really means as far as being a lung for the country and its position in the biosphere?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people, when they think of lungs of Mother Earth, you know, they think of the Amazon rainforest. But the reality of it is Canada's boreal forest extends all the way from Alaska, all the way down to central British Columbia, all the way across, through northern Quebec, all the way across Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Ontario, northern Alberta, portions of British Columbia, you know. And this is a forest that is millions and millions of acres in size and that provides an incredible service to, you know, all life on the planet by cleaning, you know, the carbon dioxide out of the air, the CO2 out of the air, greenhouse gases. And also, you know, it's home to hundreds of local First Nations communities that have lived there for time immemorial, and just an insane amount of life, in terms of critical plants and waterways, and you name it, it's all there. And the reality of it is the tar sands and development attached to the tar sands is fracturing the boreal forest because to get at the oil underneath the boreal forest, they have to clear cut it, and then they have to build roads and pipelines all through this pristine, beautiful wilderness. And you know, the reality of it is that when you fracture the integrity of critical habitats like the boreal forest, you make it susceptible to the vulnerabilities of, you know, things like the global climate crisis. And when you build roads, when you build, exploratory cut lines, you know, looking for oil through northern Alberta, what you're building actually are roadways for things like the pine beetle, which has decimated forests in Alaska, which has decimated, you know, thousands of acres of forests in British Columbia and is now moving through Alberta. The reality of it is that, we need critical habitats like the boreal forest to be able to minimize the, global climate crisis as much as possible. And we need to shut down the tar sands, if we're ever going to have a hope a hope to be able to provide some kind of future for our children that is livable.
Glad you brought that up, because the ice that's melting and the removal of the boreal forest is going to allow a lot of methane to escape from the peats and the bogs that were up there. So what we're talking about is the difference between a global climate situation to a fast accelerating climate crisis.
Well, you know, I think that when we look at the climate crisis and the drivers of climate change, you know, there are many, many layers. There are many, you know, complexities within climate science that different folks around the globe are focused on. Some are focused on the sea ice off of Greenland that supports the land-based ice on that continent from slipping into the ocean and driving up the global water levels by a couple of meters. Some people are looking at Antarctica. You know, there are those that are looking at, you know, black carbon formation on, you know, the Arctic polar ice caps that's creating, you know, more heat and melting the ice caps faster as a result of solar radiation, not reflecting off the white snow like mirrors, but being absorbed by the black carbon accumulating by our fossil fuel economy and actually melting it quicker. And the reality of it is tar sands, as I mentioned, is one of the primary drivers of the global climate catastrophe. You know, by 2030, it'll represent enough greenhouse gas emissions that will be more than Canada's entire vehicle fleet, which is staggering, you know. And all of this, of course, feeding into glaciers receding, river levels dropping, water scarcity becoming a very harsh reality, precipitation changing as a result of climate change, changing ecosystems. And, of course, you mentioned as well the difference between, you know, southern and northern climate effects. You know, some of the Inuit and Dene people in the north are seeing all kinds of, you know, devastating effects right now, here and today, as a result of the permafrost melting. And in places like northern Russia and Siberia, and in places like Alaska and Northwest Territories, Nunavut and Yukon, and Greenland, you know, where the permafrost is melting, there are vast stores of methane that exists in these frozen bogs, basically, that is being released as a result of a much warmer summer season. We're talking about a 5-degree change in some Arctic regions compared to a 1-degree change that you or I would see living here along the U.S.-Canada border.
Well, even the 1-degree change that we're seeing is already bringing us torrential downpours every time it rains, with intense lightning strikes that are setting forest fires. The change has already affected southern Ontario and places in the States, and it's going to continue like that. My concern is, how much faster will it speed up? Because in the last 2 years, it seems to have increased by fivefold from my observations.
Well, you know, I don't have the answer to that, nor do I think scientists, you know, but one thing that all the leading scientists, including Jim Henson, who's the main leading scientist for NASA, all agree on is that, you know, we're already at that critical tipping point that you were talking about earlier, a place where runaway climate change will occur. And, you know, that's why I'm saying that, you know, both Western science and our own indigenous traditional knowledge carriers, including, Chief Warren Lyons of the Haudenosaunee, he's a faith keeper. You know, a few years ago at an Amnesty International human rights conference in Minnesota, you know, Chief Warren Lyons pulled me and a young chief, Yvonne Peter, from the Gwech'en village of Arctic Village, you know, who's been fighting to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge from oil and gas development, aside, and he told us both. He said, you know, you young men have a responsibility to go around and to talk about this global climate crisis, because it's kind of like the Richter scale, you know, where one is bad, but two is 1,000 times worse than one, and three is 1,000 times worse than two. It just compounds. And that's what's going to happen with runaway climate change if we don't shut off the tap right now, if we don't stop burning coal and dirty forms of energy like, you know, oil and gas right now, and invest, you know, and take a massive undertaking in our society towards a new economic and energy paradigm, we're going to see effects of climate change compound and compound, and we're seeing that now.
Yes.
you know, with more violent hurricanes, with hurricanes, you know, and typhoons emerging in places where they've never been before.
Yeah, unfortunately, and it's polluting more of the fresh water as a result.
Of course, of course.
So it's a complete cycle, and the tar sands is the biggest, worst part of the key of that cycle, that circle of what's changing the climate. And we're having a very cool summer here in southern Ontario, and some younger people say, what about climate change? I don't understand this. You know,
well, that's just it. You know, the other thing that the listeners, you know, and that we all should be aware of is that we all have a fundamental responsibility to fight for justice, to make sure that, you know, those that are vulnerable are not being exploited. And the reality of it is, when we think about and talk about climate change, when we talk about energy development, there are many communities that are much more vulnerable, either because of their proximity to a large-scale development like the tar sands, or because of their vulnerability and their economic ability to both react to, deal with, and recover from violent, unpredictable weather associated to climate change. When Hurricane Rita and Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans, it was plain as day who was vulnerable. It was African Americans, Latinos, and Asian people that we've seen on the news.
That's right.
That were left behind in that city, that were left behind by the Bush administration. It took 5 days for the most powerful country on the planet, the United States government, to get water to the dome where, you know, most of the communities of color that were left behind by the federal government were waiting for critical services.
And yet,
5 days.
And yet they can send help immediately across the world.
Oh, yeah. Well, when it serves their interest, yeah, they'll send all kinds of help.
And it's not, we don't need this oil for cars. I mean, I'm sick of seeing the car commercials. We cannot seem to think about being a society without a car involved in our lives, which is very sad. We've been very brainwashed.
Mm-hmm.
And there are alternatives for fueling, a source of wheels and something we can get in to haul ourselves across the countryside. They've been around for decades.
Well, I think that, you know, part of this massive undertaking is really taking a look. You know, what we're dealing with today is a battle of values, okay? Is the American dream really what we want, you know? Or is the American dream, you know, becoming such a polarized and inaccessible thing that it's actually an American nightmare for many communities living within the United States, or being affected by the United States' military and economic agenda? I think that, you know, the reality of it is things are a lot different than they were in the 50s, you know, and we have to really assess and reevaluate our relationship to the sacredness of Mother Earth as humanity. And, you know, part of that is reassessing the way we produce food, the way we heat our homes, the way we have transportation. I mean, it's ridiculous that there aren't high-speed railway systems here in Canada or in the United States. I mean, Europe's had them for decades. You know, that the automobile, highways, and oil and gas sector industries, you know, they work in tandem. And the reality of it is that we have to take back sovereignty from these corporate interests. We have to have a separation of oil and state, just like we had a separation of church and state,
exactly,
you know, hundreds of years ago.
Unfortunately, they are the ones with the money, and they are the ones that make the TV ads, and they are the ones that lobby governments, and it's our whole democratic system is upside down.
But that's why we got to organize, you know, we got to organize political base of resistance. You know, we don't have to change everybody, just enough to create enough pressure and friction. Because for the most part, you know, if we're able to change structurally, you know, laws of this society, most people will follow those laws, and, you know, including the oil and gas sector.
Okay. We've really been thankful for your time this morning. You've spent a lot of time, and you've given us an amazing amount of information. I really wish there was a way that we could bring you to Hamilton to speak to a packed audience, say, at the auditorium at McMaster University. Other,
you know,
people need to hear that. Is there a way that it's possible for you to come to Hamilton, do you think?
Well, you know, I do public speaking quite a bit. You know, if you can work with folks to cover my expenses, you know, I'd be willing to explore setting a date to come down anytime.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
There were a number of us who took a tour of the tar sands, people from Alberta and from Canada, and we went by bus, and also some of us went up in a helicopter and flew over the sands. And to be very honest, and I know I speak for the whole group of us, we were devastated by what we saw and smelled and experienced. I have to say that for me, the tar sands are Canada's Mordor. The air is foul. The water is being drained and poisoned. Giant tailing ponds, of course, line the Athabasca River. What stunned me from the air was how close they are to the Athabasca and what might happen if there were a spill. And the tar sands really is a vast, slow-motion oil spill. Monitoring for the projects is increasingly being turned over to the industry. The industry is increasingly hostile. We stopped our bus several times on a public highway paid for by taxpayers, and were told very rudely and with kind of threats behind them by very rude security guards to move on, get on that bus, put those cameras away. We were outside the main gate of the Syncrude plant, and you know where it says welcome, the big one that says welcome. We stopped our bus, stood there on the road, we were not on their property, and were told in no uncertain terms to get out fast. The pace of growth in the tar sands is totally, totally unsustainable, with massive new developments underway. All of this and the destruction of Alberta's heritage, both human and resource, is being done because of our NAFTA obligation to supply energy to the United States, and only put off for really what is just going to be a few years, what the inevitable shift to conservation and energy alternatives from fossil fuels. I mean, we're all going to have to move there as the world hits peak oil and peak gas. And I want to remind us that as well under NAFTA, the American energy companies currently operating in the tar sands have the right to sue under Chapter 11 for potentially billions of dollars worth of compensation if the Alberta government were ever to move to limit the water use and access to water that they are now using or even potentially using in future developments. And I also just briefly want to bring attention to the McClellan Lake watershed, which was singled out during the Alberta government's special places process for protection. It's a very unique bog and wetland habitat, which unfortunately has a billion barrels of oil under it. And as soon as the companies found this out and True North made an application for a license, the Alberta government dropped the ball. And in fact, the mining, scientists are warning us, will effectively destroy this watershed. And both the Canadian and Alberta governments have absolutely abdicated responsibilities to wash their hands of it. So at the Council of Canadians, we would like to add our voices to those in Alberta and elsewhere calling for a total halt to the mining of the McClellan watershed, and also the protection of this watershed as a UNESCO heritage site.
This has been The Other Side of the News. I am your host, Maggie Hughes. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, something in the air, going down, coming around, spreading everywhere, agitating people like a
tiger. You can find me on radio.
Snap up on you.